Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off once again, we're going to summarize the latest concerning the coronavirus pandemic. First of all, the good news. For the past 3 weeks, we've seen a drop in the infection rate, hospitalization rate, and death rate coming from the coronavirus. And many people think that's because the holiday hump is over. In other words, once you get exposed, it takes about 5 days to 14 days for you to become symptomatic and then begin the process of infecting other people. And so we're witnessing the end of the Christmas pandemic. Pretty soon we'll see a spike from the Super Bowl. But other than that, we're seeing an overall decrease in the infection and the death rate. That's the good news. So what's the bad news? The bad news is that it's a race against time. Because on the other hand, the virus continues to mutate. We have not one, but two very dangerous mutations coming from the United Kingdom and South Africa. And those versions of the virus are more infectious and deadlier than the original. So why is it a race against time? Because we have to up the vaccination rate. The way to stop these mutant viruses from taking over is to squash it. And that means vaccination. So we have to vaccinate more people to prevent the virus from mutating to create a more lethal, more deadlier, and more infectious version of the virus. And then let me say a few things about the far future. Scientists are now beginning to ask a simple question. What will the virus look like 10, 20, 100 years from now? And some people are saying that, well, maybe the virus will never go away. It'll be with us forever. Because think of the Spanish flu of 1918. Killed more people than World War I. But it's still here. It's just not as infectious as it was 100 years ago. So in other words, some people are saying that in the coming decades, we'll treat it like the seasonal flu and have to get booster shots every year. And also, if you looked outside, you notice there's a lot of snow outside over most of the country. And you may say to yourself, well, there goes the global warming theory. Earth is not warming up. We're gripped by old man winter. But you see, there is a link there. There's a theory that says that global warming is actually accelerating the monster storms that are now gripping the United States of America. It's a theory, but I'll present that theory in a few moments. And then I'd like to say congratulations. Not one, not two, but three probes going to Mars, the United Arab Emirates, China, and the United States. Every 2 years, we launch probes to the Red Planet. And yes, they're now reaching the Red Planet, sending back pictures from our distant neighbor. And speaking about our space, asteroids are in the news. It turns out that on March 21st, a monster asteroid the size of the Golden Gate Bridge, about 1 mile across, will come within a whisker of hitting the Earth. Now, it will miss. We've been tracking it for several years. And on March 21st, it'll come within 1 million miles. Think about that. That's less than 1% of the distance from the Earth to the Moon. So take an orange and a marble. And the orange would be the Earth, the marble would be the Moon, and then skim the Earth within 1% of the distance between the Earth and the Moon. Well, there's no danger that it will hit the Earth, but scientists are going to be tracking it very carefully. And speaking of that, 2029 is also a year for astronomy, because then a real killer asteroid will come whizzing by the Earth. A killer asteroid that, in principle, might actually hit us in 2036, in which case it'll be sufficient to wipe out an entire country. So we'll say a few things about killer asteroids in today's program. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story is, once again, the good news. There's a trend because of the fact that the winter madness and all the Christmas activities and family get-togethers, that's past. And we're seeing the gradual decline in the infection rate, the death rate, as a direct consequence. And we'll see another smaller spike because of the Super Bowl. But overall, we're seeing fewer people being hospitalized. That's the good news. What's the bad news? The bad news is it's a race against time. Because on the other side, the virus is mutating. We've been tracking it for the last several months. In fact, the United Kingdom variety and the South African variety, and we've had to revise our estimate of how dangerous they are. At first, it was said that the United Kingdom version of the virus is more infectious, but that's about it. It's just more infectious than the previous version. The latest evidence seems to indicate that, nope, it's more lethal. And then the question is, the wild card is the South African version. Now, these two versions are more infectious than the ordinary version of the coronavirus, meaning that they will eventually take over. In fact, in the United States, it's believed that in just 1 month, in March, in just 1 month, it'll be the dominant strain in the United States. That's how fast this virus is replicating in the United States. Now, the danger is especially the South African mutation, because those mutations are taking place in the spike protein of the virus. When you see a picture of the virus, it looks like a corona. There's spikes coming out of it, looks like the sun. These spikes are called protein spikes, and they're like keys. Keys that unlock the machinery of the cells of your lung, allowing the virus to inject its deadly cargo into your cells, and as a consequence, you die, or you wind up in the intensive care unit. Well, it turns out that many of the mutations are concentrated where you see the protein spikes. That's the danger. The danger is that some of these mutations may make it easier for the virus to unlock the lock system of your cell, and so the virus can easily gain access to your cells of your body. So that's the danger. The danger is that the longer we prevent vaccination because of shortages, the slower the vaccination process takes place, the faster the virus will mutate and cause all sorts of havoc. For example, if you were treated for tuberculosis or another serious illness, they always say, be sure to take your antibiotics to the very end. Don't stop in the middle. Because if you stop in the middle, the germs will still grow and mutate. And then we have resistant forms of bacteria spreading into the bacterial gene pool. Same thing here. The only way to stop this is to vaccinate as many people as we can, as rapidly as we can, so there's no time for the virus to mutate. So in other words, it's a race against time. And already it's having an effect in the United States. The UK virus has been seen already throughout most of the country. The South African variety has only been seen, fortunately, in a few states, and it's being looked at very carefully to see whether it could evade some of our vaccines. And just remember that some scientists are saying that if these mutations get out of control, we may have to have another booster shot. We may have to have yet another annual seasonal shot in addition to the two shots that you may have already had. So in other words, it could be like the seasonal flu. We may have to have another shot in order to counteract the mutations that occur, just like with the flu virus. So in other words, the pandemic of 1918, of 100 years ago, That virus killed more people than World War I. But it didn't go away. It faded away because of the fact that people began to develop immune defenses against that virus. It faced a choice, an unconscious choice. One, stay the same, and eventually people will become immune and you will die. Or mutate to a milder version. And that's what we think happened to the flu virus of 1918. It, quote, faded away. But in the process, it killed more people than World War I. So that's the danger. And so in other words, it's a race against time. We have to vaccinate more people more rapidly so that the virus doesn't have time to mutate. That's the challenge for today. Now also, if you look outside, it's obvious that the United States is being gripped by a cold snap. Snow everywhere. In New York City, 3 feet of snow. Everywhere you go, you see huge piles of snow. And then a cynic may say, ha, so where's your global warming theory? People said the Earth is warming up. Doesn't look like it. Just look outside, dummy. And you see that the Earth is covered with snow. But you see, there is a link between what's happening now and global warming. First of all, why are we being gripped by this cold spell? Watch the evening news very carefully and look at satellite photographs. Usually the jet stream comes over Alaska, goes south through, let's say, South Dakota, and then goes back up into Canada again. That's where you might normally see the progress of the jet stream. And what's driving this jet stream in turn is the polar vortex. Think of a cylinder, like a top, a spinning top at the North Pole. This cylinder is spinning very rapidly, containing super cold air. It in turn influences the jet stream further south. Now, it turns out that more recently, the polar vortex is becoming more unstable. It's beginning to wander. And if you watch the evening news, you can actually see it. You can actually see that the cold areas of the Earth are widening as the polar vortex wobbles, spreading incredibly cold air south into Canada, into the United States, as far south as Texas. So what's causing the instability of the polar vortex? Scientists think, and this is just a theory, so let me say that this is not universally accepted, but many climatologists think that what's driving that is global warming. You see, the stability of the polar vortex is at stake. What makes the polar vortex stable? This hurricane, this tornado on top of the North Pole, is stable if there is a wide differential gap between the inside temperature and the outside temperature. That's normal. So there's an inside temperature of the polar vortex, which is quite low, and of course, warmer air when you go toward Canada and North America. But you see, as global warming starts to warm up the Canadian air, it decreases the differential between the cold air at the center of the polar vortex and the air outside the polar vortex. Ergo, it becomes unstable. It starts to wobble. That's what's happening now. If you don't believe me, just look at the evening news and you can actually see the jet stream barreling all the way down to near Texas, coming back up again, wandering because of the fact that the polar vortex is unstable. And what is causing that? Some climatologists believe that it is global warming. Global warming by decreasing the differential in temperature between the inside and the outside of the polar vortex is causing the polar vortex to wobble, sending super cold air into your backyard. Also, news from outer space. Once again, I'd like to extend my congratulations to the United Arab Emirates, the Chinese, and the United States as not one, not two, but three probes reach the red planet. You know, back in the old days, it was only the United States and Russia that were playing this game, but now we see other countries. In fact, the European Union, India, and now the United Arab Emirates. and the Chinese are sending interplanetary probes into space. And why is that? Well, that's because technology is not the province of any one country. The skies are up for grabs. You put down the money, you do the research, and you too could explore outer space. There's no patent, there's no copyright on the space program. And the United Arab Emirates specifically mentions in their press releases that they're doing it not for the greater glory of their country. No, they're doing it as a beacon, as trying to be a role model for young Arab youth, that science and technology is the way of the future. And so they want this probe to Mars, not necessarily to extract new scientific data, but to be an inspiration. An inspiration for young Arab youth to realize that that's where their future lies. And my point of view is very simple. Where does wealth come from? The wealth that we see around us does not come from taxation. That's what politicians say. But taxes simply rob Peter to pay Paul. If you talk to an economist as to what creates wealth, an economist would say, oh, that's printing money. That's all. You just print money. But that robs your grandchildren to pay off your debts today. It's a zero-sum game again. I say the source of wealth, the ultimate originator of wealth, is science and technology. In the 1800s, it was thermodynamics, the steam engine, and the mechanical age, the industrial age, set into motion by science. That was the first wave of prosperity. The second wave of prosperity was the electric age. By harnessing the power of electricity and magnetism, we lit up our cities, created dynamos and engines, and electrified our life. And the third wave of technology and wealth generation was the computer age. Much of the gross domestic product of the entire planet is wedded to computers, which in turn are made possible because of the quantum theory. And now we're entering the fourth era. Artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, biotechnology. And so science and technology is the source, the ultimate source of progress and wealth. And the UAE wants to use their probe to Mars to inspire their young people so that they want to become part of the future. And speaking about outer space, we are going to have a close call with an asteroid on March 21st, very soon. In fact, with binoculars, you may be able to see a giant asteroid whizzing overhead. This asteroid is about 1 mile across. It is about the size of the Golden Gate Bridge, and it's not going to hit the Earth. So don't worry about it, but it's going to whiz by the Earth and miss us by a whisker. What is that whisker? It'll come within 1 million miles of the Earth. Think of the distance between the Earth and the Moon. It'll skim the Earth at a distance of 1%, less than 1% of the distance from the Earth to the Moon. That's how close this will come. It was first spotted in 2001. Scientists have been tracking it, realizing that this will be the biggest asteroid to cross our path in many a while. But we also know it's not going to create any impact. How do we know that? Because we have Newton's laws of gravity. Using computers, we can calculate the trajectory with razor-sharp precision, and we know it's going to miss us. But astronomers are really focused on 2029. Just 8 years from now, we will have a preview of what could actually hit the planet Earth. You know, we are blissfully unaware. For millennia, thousands of years, we've been blissfully unaware that we live in the middle of a cosmic shooting gallery, that asteroids are whizzing by all the time. Once in a while, they hit the Earth and cause enormous havoc. 65 million years ago, one asteroid or comet plowed into Mexico and wiped out the dinosaurs, for God's sake, making possible the rise of mammals, including you and me. Well, in 2029, Just 8 years from now, a killer asteroid will come whizzing by the Earth. It'll miss in 2029. But in the second pass, in 2036, all bets are off. In 2036, there is a chance that it may hit the Earth. So let me explain. The asteroid's name is Apophis. How big is it? It is about as big as the Eiffel Tower or as big as the Rose Bowl. It's about 1,000 feet across. Now, the objects that plowed into Russia are city busters, capable of taking out London or Moscow, but not much more than that. Apophis, on the other hand, is a nation buster. It'd be sufficient to take out Germany or England. And being 1,000 feet across, it'll cause damage that we've never seen in recorded history. That's why scientists are going to track it very carefully when it comes whizzing by in 2029. In fact, it'll come so close that you'll be able to look up and see it. That's right, you'll be able to see it. It'll come underneath our satellites. Think about that. We have satellites whizzing out there out to 20,000 miles, and Apophis will come so close to the Earth, it'll skim right underneath some of our asteroids. Now, the danger is not actually 2029. We're going to watch it carefully, track its motion very carefully, shoot radar beams off it, maybe even launch a rocket to intercept it. But in 2036, it makes a return trip. That's the danger. It turns out that in 2036, there's a tiny probability that it will actually hit the Earth and become a nation buster, capable of taking out a good chunk of the United States. So what's the error? The error is that when it comes really close to the planet Earth in 2029, it'll skim the atmosphere, and its trajectory could be altered a bit. Now, we have Newton's laws of gravity, which work very well in the vacuum of outer space. But Newton's laws of gravity become very complicated once you factor in friction and the atmosphere. And we don't know the composition of the asteroid. We don't know its shape. We don't know its consistency. It could be that the asteroid is a collection of smaller asteroids held together by gravity. Or it could be that it's one solid piece of rock. We don't know. It could be tumbling, in which case that could also affect its trajectory. So in 2029, scientists have a mission. And that mission is to watch as close as they can, reflect radar beams off Apophis in order to calculate whether or not it is spherical, cylindrical, shaped like a peanut, which it probably is, or a collection of loose rocks held together by gravity, because that'll determine how it interacts with the atmosphere, and that in turn will determine its trajectory in 2036. So in other words, Newton's laws of gravity and motion will work very well in the vacuum of outer space where there is no friction to worry about. But as it skims the Earth, it'll get into our atmosphere, and at that point, all bets are off. We simply don't know whether or not the asteroid is stable, whether it's a pile of rocks, whether it tumbles or whatever, and the slightest jar in its orbit could actually determine whether or not it'll hit us in 2036. Like I said before, we have been blissfully unaware of the fact that these things have been coming close to the Earth since time immemorial. This is not new at all. We just didn't know it until we entered the space race. And now let me say a few things about Oumuamua. There's a book by Avi Loeb, former chairman of the astronomy department at Harvard University, who wrote a book about extraterrestrials. He believes that a comet or meteor-like object that skimmed through our solar system a few years ago was created by an artificial civilization, a civilization capable of creating a starship. Well, people have asked me, what's my personal point of view? Well, of course, it was Carl Sagan who once said that remarkable claims require remarkable proof. I'm not sure that we have the proof that this comet or meteor was extraterrestrial. We tracked it. We do know that it came from outside the solar system. We do know that it's a visitor from another star system by simply running the videotape backwards and seeing where it came from. We know that. We also know that its trajectory was not typical of an object simply barreling its way through the solar system. Maybe it tumbled, it deviated, and its shape was cigar shape, which is also very, very interesting. So Professor Loeb at Harvard said, when you rule out all the other alternatives, maybe it's extraterrestrial. Well, I think we should be open to the idea. Some people have criticized him because he's a member of the establishment, and members of the establishment are not supposed to raise the boogeyman of aliens from outer space. But I think it's fair game. We should look into the possibility that it was a solar sail or a rocket ship of some sort that came through our solar system. However, in the back of our minds, we'd also should be very clear that it's a long shot. Chances are, and this is my personal point of view, chances are it was some kind of anomaly, perhaps a burst of the solar wind, perhaps an impact from a micrometeorite, something which dislodged its orbit slightly so that our radar tracking the motion of this object would infer that it's being guided by a pilot of some sort, when it's actually just fluctuations. Fluctuations due to the solar wind, micrometeor impacts, anomalies in outer space. Who knows what could happen in outer space? So for the most part, we do know that in empty space, we can use Newton's laws of motion with enormous accuracy, but we have to compensate for the fact that there are anomalous conditions in outer space. Micrometeorite impacts, for example, could easily cause the thing to tumble or to deviate from a path normally predicted by Newton's laws of gravity. And so the bottom line is, A, we should be open to the idea that maybe the object was extraterrestrial. We cannot rule it out. But B, in the back of our minds, if you were to put money on the table, chances are it was a natural anomaly of some sort rather than a messenger from the stars. Now, of course, it's always good to fantasize about these things. Maybe one of these days we'll intercept one. Maybe one of these days it'll come through our solar system, we'll have advanced warning, and we'll send a probe, just like we sent a probe to visit Halley's Comet back in the 1980s. And now we regularly send probes to intercept asteroids. Maybe in the future, we will then intercept an extraterrestrial rocket ship. You can't rule that out. Well, that concludes the first part of exploration. In the second part of exploration, we're going to continue our discussion about the future with futurist Ray Kurzweil. We're going to talk about robots, artificial intelligence. What will the next 10, 50, 100 years look like? So stay tuned for the second half of exploration and go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, to find out what I'm up to. Okay, so stay tuned for the second half of exploration when we talk about your future. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Well, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about the future your future? What will life be like in the future? What will a computer, the internet, medicine, what will they look like in the future? We're going to bring on futurist Ray Kurzweil, who's written about the singularity and what happens when machines begin to rival human intelligence. And also, I should point out that if you want to know more about what I do, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers, and I have about 4 million fans on Facebook. And so once again, the website you should go to find out more about my work is mkaku, mkaku.org.
Mr. Kurzweil, the first question for you is, how did you first get interested in robots and artificial intelligence?
I've actually had in mind being an inventor since I was at the age of 5. And age of 12, I discovered computers. I built some primitive computers myself and got access to one as part of a summer job, and quickly became fascinated with the ability to kind of model the world, albeit primitively at that time, in the computer and create virtual realities, and also model our thinking processes. Quickly became interested actually in pattern recognition, which is my view is the fundamental basis of human intelligence rather than logical, sequential, analytical thinking. And a project I did in high school was to build pattern recognition models of melodies, and I would feed in the melodies of Mozart or Chopin, and it would build a pattern recognition model and then write original melodies in the same style from that model, which were recognizable, kind of sounded like second-rate compositions from a second-rate student of Chopin or Mozart. And that started really a lifelong fascination in pattern recognition, which is really my primary technical field.
Okay, and let's talk about your book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. First of all, what is a spiritual machine? Is that a contradiction in terms?
The primary concept of spirituality is really consciousness. If we consider a being or an entity to be conscious, then we consider it to have spiritual value. And if you look at all the different religious traditions, what they really mean by a soul and by spiritual reality is consciousness, an entity that really has subjective experience and can feel pain and joy, as opposed to just the conventional concept of a machine, which is operating by some kind of automatic process. And we don't worry much today about causing pain and suffering to our computer programs. But our computer software is still millions of times simpler than the human brain. We do find, if we look at the human brain, that we actually can model it with great precision neurons and even substantial clusters of neurons. We can talk more about that. And we will have machines, which is to say non-biological entities, that do have the complexity and richness and depth of the human brain, indeed modeled on the principles of operation of the human brain within a few decades. And when these entities claim to be conscious, to be joyful, fearful, angry, and so on, unlike, let's say, the computer characters in video games today, those entities a few decades from now will be as convincing as humans. They'll have all the subtle emotional cues that we associate with somebody really having those subjective experiences. So are they conscious? Some philosophers will say, no, they're not squirting human neurotransmitters, and you can't be conscious if you're not biological. But there won't be any clear distinction. We won't be able to separate them from any kind of objective observation. And my prediction, and this is really not a philosophical statement, but a psychological and political prediction, is that the bulk of humans, unenhanced humans, will consider these non-biological entities to be conscious. In any event, they'll be very intelligent, they'll be able to convince us that they're conscious, and they'll get angry at us if we don't believe them. And it'll be an actual political and legal issue as well. In my view, the real issue of consciousness is not something we can resolve scientifically, because science involves third-party objective observations consciousness is inherently first-party subjective experience, and there is a gap there. Some people go on to say, well, since it's not scientific, it's not an important question. I would turn that around and say it's really a very fundamental question. It shows that there is a need for philosophy outside of science. But these will become real compelling questions as opposed to just abstract philosophical debates in this 21st century.
Okay, and let's talk about the past first as a guide to the future. Back in the 1950s and 60s, there were dazzling breakthroughs in artificial intelligence theory. We had the first machines, for example, that could play chess and checkers, not very well, but they could at least play the game. They could solve simple algebra theorems. They could even play doctor to a degree and do simple diagnoses. And there were all these fantastic predictions that just within a few years, humans will be put in a zoo, we'll all be zoo animals, and our creations will throw peanuts at us and make us dance behind bars because look at how fast computers are learning. And then there was the movie 2001, and, well, the year 2001 came and went, and we still do not have the robot Hal, the murderous robot in Arthur C. Clarke's famous movie that could pilot a spaceship, could play chess, and interact with humans as if it was a human itself. So the question is, what happened to the dream of the 1950s and 60s when everyone was predicting that humans would be obsolete by the 1970s?
Well, your observation is correct. I would say wasn't everyone predicting that. There were some famous predictions from Simon and Newell at Carnegie Mellon, which came into disrepute. But there was over-optimism because machines were doing adult activities, like solving some unsolved theorems from Russell and Whitehead and doing these adult activities, playing chess, in some narrow cases, making medical diagnoses as well as doctors and so on. So it seemed it wouldn't be long before a computer could do everything. Another 10 years went by, and we realized that computers, while they were able to do these high-level analytic tasks, were not able to do some things that a four-year-old can do, which is, let's say, tell the difference between a dog and a cat or recognize faces. And this is really a fundamental issue, in my view, that the fundamental basis of human intelligence is not analytic, logical thinking. And, in fact, machines can do that a lot better than humans in most cases. The fundamental basis of human intelligence is pattern recognition. We can see that in the contrast with how machines play chess, which is this minimax combinatorial expansion of move counter moves, which it does largely through brute force. We can look at millions or even hundreds of millions of board positions in a second. Kasparov says he looks at less than one board position in a second, but humans use their tremendous powers of pattern recognition to recognize situations they've thought about before. And we don't think fast enough. Our interneuronal connections compute 200 calculations per second, which is about 10 to 100 million times slower than electronic circuits, but we have 100 trillion of them, all computing simultaneously, self-organizing. Information is really represented as a pattern. No key connection is all that important. It's a very different paradigm from computers we're used to, and it's a very good architecture for recognizing patterns in a profound way. That is really the heart of human intelligence. Now, we have been making steady progress in pattern recognition. I could give many examples of that, both in terms of recognizing language and speech. Character recognition have all improved gradually, even in chess. Machines have become better qualitative players, so you have Deep Fritz and the current programs working actually as well as Deep Blue, despite the fact that they're about 100 times slower, because they're doing a better job of pattern recognition. So we are making steady progress on that, and that is really the key issue now. And part of the guidance we'll get in terms of creating the templates of human-level pattern recognition is to actually understand how humans do it, which brings up the issue of reverse engineering the human brain. It wasn't long ago before people were saying, well, you know, our intelligence is just below the level necessary to actually understand our own intelligence. But what we're finding is that as we're able to actually instrument the brain and see what's going on, and our ability to scan the human brain and to actually see the connections and the firings of neuronal connections and synapses is increasing, actually doubling every year, we are able to develop very detailed mathematical models of neurons and neuron clusters. Lloyd Watts and his colleagues have actually created a reverse engineering of the whole acoustic area of the brain involving 12 different regions with a great deal of detail, have re-implemented that in software and submitted that to psychoacoustic tests, which performs very comparably to human auditory perception. If you follow all the exponential trends in computation, communication, brain scanning, exponentially growing knowledge of the human brain, it's, I think, conservative to say we will have reverse engineered the principles of operation of the human brain within a quarter century. And that will provide us, you know, more powerful biologically inspired methods for pattern recognition.
Okay, well, we've had several AI specialists on the radio show before, among them Rodney Brooks of MIT, the director of the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And I asked him a key question, and that is, well, how powerful are the MIT robots? And he was very proud to say that he's the godfather of the Mars rover, an advanced robot which actually wandered on the surface of Mars. But he was honest and said that his most advanced robots have the intelligence of a cockroach. In fact, cockroaches do it a lot better, he said. Cockroaches can scope out environments, see obstacles, boulders, maneuver around them, and they're quite good at this. And robots at Carnegie Mellon and Stanford, well, when they walk down the hall, it's lucky if they don't gouge out a piece of the wallpaper when they walk down the hallway. So how smart are our robots? Are our robots really so dumb that they are really insect level at the present time, barely able to understand chairs, tables, the ceiling, the roof, people maneuvering around the room? How smart are the robots today?
Well, robots and artificial intelligence in general are operating far below biological levels, both in terms of hardware and software, and I think it's worthwhile talking about both of those, but also to understand that we're making exponential progress in both of these realms. And exponential progress really sneaks up on you. And just to use an analogy, Kasparov played the best machines in the 1990 at chess, and they were pathetic, and he scoffed at them. And it was just inconceivable that they would ever reach his level. But they gradually got better. They're doubling in performance every year, gaining 40 chess points every year, and chess scale is exponential. And then they surpassed him, operating at or beyond his level by 1997. We'll see the same thing in other areas. And it's easy to lose sight of tremendous power of exponential growth. We are doubling computation at least every year, and we'll talk a little bit later about the issue of Moore's Law, but I believe that this phenomenon will continue past Moore's Law into three-dimensional computing. And in terms of software, we're making exponential progress, as I mentioned, in understanding and reverse engineering the principles of operation of the human brain. There's a new brain scanning method now that's being developed, which will be available within a couple of years, that will actually be able to see individual nerve fibers firing in a cluster of thousands of neurons at very high resolution, very high resolution also in terms of time scale, which will really give us the means to reverse engineer those circuits. I mean, so far, we've been really unable to see what's going on. It's very hard to diagnose a circuit if you can't instrument it. But if you can put sensors on in the right place and see what's going on, it's very straightforward to reverse engineer. The human brain, of course, is created by a genome that doesn't have very much information in it. Even though the human brain itself appears to contain thousands of trillions of bytes, the genome only has about 12 million bytes of information to characterize the initial design of the brain, because there's a lot of random wiring in the way it's actually constructed, which then self-organizes to reflect its experience with the world. So the principles of operation are of a complexity that we can't understand, and that will provide us at least biologically inspired paradigms for the software of intelligence. And so the capabilities of of all of these systems will improve quite steadily, and we will master different levels of biological intelligence. Ultimately, I believe within less than three decades, by 2029, these machines will be operating at human levels and will combine human levels of intelligence, the subtlety and suppleness of human pattern recognition with some of the natural advantages of machines, most notable of which is the ability to instantly share knowledge.
Now let's talk a little bit about Moore's Law, the doubling time you mentioned of 18 months for computers, meaning that at Christmas time, your computers are almost twice as powerful as they were the previous Christmas. Exponential growth in bacteria, for example, eventually seals off, otherwise bacteria would take over the entire planet Earth. And exponential factors do taper off because of external effects. Now, with Moore's Law and computers, the engine driving Moore's Law is ultraviolet etching technology by which we can etch tinier and tinier transistors on a silicon wafer the size of your thumb. But eventually, the transistors get so tiny, you hit the quantum theory. And at that point, you get short circuits. Leakage takes place. All hell breaks loose. And by 2020, all bets are off. The Intel, one of the senior engineers at Intel, admitted recently in a major paper that, yes, they can see the end of the tunnel. And that is, at a certain point, it's going to be prohibitively difficult to etch silicon components that are tinier and tinier, and eventually you get leakage because you don't know where the electrons are. Some people have said, let's make three-dimensional cubes. But the problem there is you have heat generation, enormous quantities of heat generated in three-dimensional cubes. So the question is, what happens after 2020 when all hell breaks loose and Silicon Valley becomes a rust belt?
Well, it's a key question. And to examine that, I've done a number of things. I have been an ardent student of technology trends. I've been measuring the actual power of different technologies for 25 years. Have a team of people doing that. One thing I did is put 49 famous computers over the last century, long before there was a Moore's Law, on an exponential chart. And this exponential growth has been going on not just for Moore's Law, but back through five different paradigms. Moore's Law, the shrinking of transistors on a flat integrated circuit, is not the first, but the fifth paradigm to provide exponential growth to computing. And every time one paradigm ran out of steam, because as you correctly point out, every method of exponential growth eventually runs out of capacity. Rabbits in Australia eat up the vegetation and stop growing exponentially. They even reverse direction. Every time that happened, another paradigm came along and started another S-curve of exponential growth. They were shrinking vacuum tubes to continue exponential growth. Finally, they couldn't shrink them anymore and keep the vacuum. That paradigm ended. Transistors came along. And the next paradigm will be three-dimensional computing. We live in a three-dimensional world. Our brain's organized in three dimensions. Our brain, by the way, uses a very cumbersome, very slow electrochemical information processing method that's 200 calculations per second. They're digitally controlled analog transactions, but they're roughly comparable to calculations, at least 10 million times slower than electronic circuits. But it gets its tremendous power from the fact that it's organized in three dimensions. Now, the brain itself is an existence proof of the feasibility of organizing circuits in three dimensions and dealing with the heat problem. I proposed three-dimensional computing as the sixth paradigm to replace Moore's Law, which was the fifth paradigm, in my book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, 4 years ago. It was considered a radical notion then. I would say it's much more of a mainstream expectation at this time. There's been tremendous progress in building working three-dimensional circuits over the last 4 years. There's been a steady flow of breakthroughs, including conceptual examinations of this thermal issue that you alluded to, and there are ways of designing the circuits in porous ways to deal with the heat issue. 1 watt of power, which would not generate that much heat, would be sufficient to emulate human brain capacity in a cube that would be very tiny. So the thermal issue is, in fact, a key challenge, but there's a lot of confidence that that's feasible. And We still have at least a dozen years to go, and what we've seen typically is when the end is in sight for a particular paradigm, it creates tremendous pressure in the R&D community to create the next paradigm, and we have a lot of advance warning this time. And already, in fact, just using conventional lithography and going to the third dimension, because after all, even conventional circuits have 14 or 15 layers of material, so they do have some three-dimensional capacity, and there's been successful efforts to build circuits with dozens and even up to 100 layers of circuitry just using conventional technique. There are many different approaches. The most effective appears to be carbon nanotubes, which is what I had predicted in my book 4 years ago.
Okay. Well, the heat problem, as you mentioned, is quite fierce. Engineers tell me that very soon even cubicle computers will generate so much heat you can fry an egg on them. Let me ask you a question about the top up, the top-down approach and the bottom-up approach. When we had Rodney Brooks on the radio, he said that there are two approaches to artificial intelligence, top-down and bottom-up. The top-down approach has dominated AI research for the last several decades, and the goal there is to have a CD-ROM with all the laws of common sense, all the laws of logic on it. You simply put the CD-ROM in a computer, and all of a sudden your computer says, I think, I am aware, I am conscious. Okay, I'm alive. That's the top-down approach, which failed rather miserably. We know that there are hundreds of millions of lines of common sense. We can't put them on a CD-ROM. There's so many of them. The other one is the bottom-up approach, which follows nature, Mother Nature, allowing machines to learn like bugs, like infants, to bump into the environment. And that approach is like a neural network approach. So could you explain to us a little bit about neural network theory? And this, of course, means that our brain, in some sense, is not really a digital computer at all, that perhaps we were sort of misled over the last 50 years in terms of the successes of silicon, but the brain is really a neural network and not really a Turing machine at all. Could you elaborate?
Well, I've always been a strong advocate of what you're referring to as the bottom-up approach. As I mentioned earlier, the brain, the design of it, is characterized by only about 12 million bytes of compressed information in the genome. You might wonder, how could that be when the brain itself contains millions of times more information than that? And the way it works is the genome specifies a particular design, but in a particular region, the actual wiring of the connection is random within certain constraints, and we know that that's the case, having watched how that process unfolds, then there's actually kind of an evolutionary process where the connections that make the most sense in the environment survive, and it's actually twice as many connections in the newborn baby's brain as exists a year later. There's a lot of self-organization, and the brain has the capacity to interact with its environment, make sense of the environment, as well as make sense of its own design and its own interconnections actually continually being repruned and reconnected to make sense of the environment and to learn. And that is really the only approach that's going to work. I think the Psyche project of Doug Lanat is interesting. It's accomplished a lot, but I never felt that we could build human-level intelligence that way. We really have to build it the way nature builds it, which is a machine that has the capacity to learn, and then provide for its education. Now, neural nets is sort of one attempt based on a crude model of how human neurons work, which actually builds lots of neuron simulators and connects them somewhat the way the brain connects them and let them self-organize. And there's a number of different approaches to neural nets. They're all very simplified from what we now know is true of actual neurons, and as we're as progress in reverse engineering the human brain progresses and we have more sophisticated and realistic models of actual neurons, we can build more realistic biologically inspired paradigms. But in general, pattern recognition, which is my field, works by emulating nature in these self-organizing methods. We set up some approach, which could be a neural net. This thing called Markov models, which is a mathematical cousin of neural nets. They're evolutionary algorithms that actually emulate evolution. And actually part of human learning has a kind of an evolutionary process take place inside the brain where the better connections that survive. And we use these techniques in our pattern recognition approach. We'll actually simulate evolution, have different solutions to a problem, compete with each other through thousands of generations of simulated evolution. And these biologically inspired methods are very powerful. They give results that are essentially unpredictable, just as sort of human decision-making is unpredictable without actually letting it unfold. And this is really the approach that will work, trying to define as analytic, logical rules every bit of common sense. It's not going to work. It's too complex, too unwieldy, and it's not how human intelligence works.
And also the age of spiritual machines. And we should also point out, however, that Moore's Law, which is the basis of many predictions about the future, is slowing down. Transistors are becoming so small that eventually the quantum theory takes over. That is, you don't know precisely where the electron is anymore, and electrons leak out. So just remember that you have to take some of these predictions with a grain of salt. Moore's Law states that computer power doubles every 18 months, but it is slowing down as we begin to reach the atomic limit. Anyway, that's it for exploration. Go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, to find out what I do. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers that you may find interesting. So once again, my website is mkaku, mkaku.org. Good day.